This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Good evening. For our family, the launching of the Sidney and Miriam Bretler Memorial Series marks the end of a generation with my father's death a little more than a year ago. It was my father's wish that what had started as the Hirschdorfer-Kantrowitz-Bretler series that honored my grandparents and aunt and uncle should continue after his death in his and my mother's memory. My parents were the youngest children in their families, and all their siblings were American-born. My grandparents were part of the mass early 20th century immigration to the U.S. My father, Sidney, was an accountant, and my mother, Miriam, a kindergarten teacher. Throughout their lives, both of my parents displayed intellectual curiosity, and after they retired, audited classes at Brooklyn College and attended Ulpan in Israel. In fact, while clearing out their apartment here, we found notes, flashcards, and compositions that my father had prepared for class. My mother was shy. They were also committed to Jewish observance and learning. Every Friday night dinner when I was growing up included a weekly quiz on what we had learned in Hebrew school. After they moved to Jerusalem, my parents continued to do almost everything together and were famous for their matching jackets and for always holding hands in the street. They made new friends at Ulpan, on the bus, and while waiting online in the supermarket. Following my mother's death, my father continued to seek intellectual stimulation and Jewish knowledge in the classes that he attended at the Pardes Institute. And I'm sorry, Alex stole my story. He especially enjoyed Alex Israel's Bible classes. And I was not surprised when Alex told us how my dad would sit quietly through class and then drop a bombshell of a question at the end. As a person who loved to attend lectures and learn, especially in the sphere of Judaic studies, it was natural for him to propose a public lecture series in English, and for the Pardes Institute to be chosen as its venue. The Hirschdorfer-Kantrowitz-Bretler series was held 7 times, hosting as speakers Uriel Simon twice, James Kugel, Yael Ziegler, my brother Mark Bretler, Elisheva Baumgarten, and Yair Zakovich. All of these lectures were related to Bible, biblical scholarship, or changing images of biblical figures. The current series and its speaker represent a departure from the biblical theme, moving to American Jewish history, another area that interested my parents. I am certain that they would have approved of the choice of Professor Jonathan Sarna as the first speaker in this new series in their memory, as I enjoyed interacting with Jonathan and his family on their trips to Boston to visit my brother. In fact, among the books in their apartment was a personalized, warmly inscribed copy of Jonathan's American Judaism. That book is now in my library. Other books from my father's library have found a home at Pardes. I thank the Pardes Institute for hosting this series and for enabling us to honor my parents' memory with an event that I know they would have appreciated and enjoyed. Yehi Zichram Baruch.
Wow. Thank you, Dina, for that marvelous memorial and introduction. It's really, for me, a very great honor to have been selected as the Sidney and Miriam Bretler lecturer. As you heard, I knew the Bretlers, and we used to see them when they would come up, and they were deeply committed to Jewish learning at every level, and they would turn out to hear lectures on a wide range of subjects, from indeed the ancient to the contemporary. The Bretlers were modest people, deeply devoted to family and community, and Dina didn't say this, but they took great pride in the achievements of their remarkable children and grandchildren. So in many ways, it seems to me that they serve as perfect role models for the Pardes community. Indeed, they embodied really the essence of Pardes, love of Torah in all of its multifarious dimensions. It seems to me that Jewish institutions don't honor mention like Sid and Miriam Brettler often enough. So it's really a privilege to be able to deliver these lectures in their memory. Now, our subject over these next 4 weeks is Jews and American politics. And once upon a time, that subject would have shocked and horrified the Jewish community. I would have gotten a letter from the ADL or its antecedent. For example, an important Jewish religious leader of the middle of the 19th century, Samuel Isaacs from Holland, regularly insisted Jews have no politics. Religion and politics have little in common. And he felt that Jews should focus on religion and ignore politics. And as we'll see later on, his son, Meyer Isaacs, held the same view. If any of you have the old 1902 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, look up. I think you can find it online, actually. Look up the article on Jews and Judaism written by the eminent Reform Rabbi Emil G. Hirsch of Chicago. And he wrote, "Politically, the Jews are divided. There is no solid Jewish vote. Most of the Jews have no political aspirations. They are loyal citizens." Note that link between loyalty and the absence of political aspirations. In a similar vein, the great Jewish leader Louis Marshall, one of the great leaders of the early 20th century, they used to say American Jewry operated under martial law, he repeatedly fulminated against Jewish group politics. If you look at his letters, a typical letter decries the establishment of a Jewish pro-Taft club in 1912, supporting the candidate William Howard Taft, even though he supported Taft in that 1912 very interesting election. That's a teaser for the third lecture. But he's utterly opposed to any plan whereby the Jewish people shall segregate themselves from the remainder of the citizens of this country for political purposes. He continued, "We have no political interests which are different from those of our fellow citizens." Now, in real life, it's very hard to sustain the notion that Jews as a group have no distinct politics or no political interests. After all, even the prophet Jeremiah, Yirmiyahu, as you can see here, way back at the beginning of the diaspora, taught us that Jews do have political interests and even political strategy. Dershuet shloma yirashir gleiti etchem shama v'palaluva ada el Hashem ki bishloma yielachem shalom. Seek the peace of the city. Whither, let's say, where I have caused you to be carried away captives, and pray unto the Lord for it, for in the peace thereof you shall have peace. I think today we would say Jeremiah advocated a rather conservative politics based on prosperity, support for the party in power, maintenance of the status quo. And in a like vein, the rabbis in Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of the Fathers, 3:2, again, you have that. They famously explained in the name of the first century deputy high priest, Rabbi Hanina, Have mitpalel bishloma shel malchut she'il malei mora'a ish et re'ehu chayim bla'o. Pray for the welfare of the government, for were it not for fear of it, people would swallow their fellows alive. A government of laws, even an oppressive government, the rabbis believed, was superior to chaos and anarchy. And indeed, if you read someone like Professor Jerry Mueller, who actually was my classmate many years ago, he wrote in his important book that modern conservatives are disposed to protect the authority and legitimacy of existing institutions because they believe human society cannot flourish without them, and that the restraints imposed by institutions are necessary to contain and guide human passions. This is a kind of Hobbesian view of the world that the rabbis had, and it lasts for a long time. The idea in Judaism is very deeply rooted that government is required to protect order, lest society disintegrate. And I don't have to tell those of you who watch the news, saw what happened when governments were overthrown in Iraq, in Libya, and so on, that the rabbis had considerable wisdom in their political teaching. So when you look historically, it's not that Jews didn't have politics. Actually, Jewish politics revolved for centuries around what the great historian Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi called a royal alliance. Throughout medieval Christian Europe, the Jews inevitably yet willingly allied themselves to the crown as the best and ultimately the only guarantor of stability and security. And you actually, in a sense, anticipate that idea, and Jews often look back to the book of Esther as a kind of proof text about this royal alliance, thanks to the activities of Jews working in and around the Persian court of King Ahasuerus. You will remember the machinations of Haman were foiled, and at the king's behest, the Jews were saved. Who knows, maybe repeated in our own day in Washington. But that idea that it's always good to have some Jews in court allied to the king, that's a very old idea in Jewish politics. And indeed, for much of the Middle Ages, Jews were in Europe, Jews were directly under the king, what was called servi camerae, serfs of the chamber, and that was their status. And so it's easy to understand why you have this idea of a royal alliance born of necessity and confirmed by history that actually becomes a kind of guiding myth for lots of Jews. Let's preserve the government, let's support the king, and so on. And when one looks, one finds that many Jews throughout history not only cast their lot with the sovereign authority, but they actually prayed fervently for its welfare. I've had a lot of calls about the prayer for the government in the last few weeks. Suddenly, people have been praying hard. And the traditional Jewish prayer for the government, which you have as document number 4, I'll get back to number 3, on page 2, it's a late 15th, early 16th century prayer recited in many diaspora synagogues. And what does it do? Unlike most Christian prayers, which underscored how Jews were, which underscored how the king was under God, these prayers call on God to bless, guard, protect, help, exalt, magnify, highly aggrandize the king and the royal family, or their American equivalent, to grant them a long and prosperous rule, to inspire them with benevolence toward us and all Israel, our brethren. Let me say a word. I'm sorry, it's a little small here. There's a reason why I picked this text. The text that's on your source sheet is from the earliest American prayer book in 1826, known as the Jackson Prayer Book. Doesn't mean Jews didn't pray before then, but they used imported prayer books before then. This is the first prayer book, full-scale prayer book. There were lesser than full-scale, but this is the first full-scale prayer book printed in the United States. I wanted you to notice something unique there. It's not related quite here, but fascinating. Note that in the prayer it says during the sitting of Congress and during the recess of Congress. If you can't see it, I get paid, you know, to send you to your ophthalmologist if you can't see this little print. But you only prayed for the Senate and the House when Congress was in session. Otherwise, they were normal citizens like the rest of us. No prayers for them. Fascinating idea, not maintained today, it reminds us that, you know, they only were elevated in importance when they were actually there in Washington. Otherwise, no prayers. Those of you who know the text, I'm not going to go through it. You can have questions. Those who know the text will see it really very closely resembles texts that those of you who remember that prayer or have an art scroll prayer book or something will recognize. Now, some of you have heard me talk about this prayer and therefore know that I consider it to be a secretly subversive prayer. Meaning Jews said what, like in Fiddler on the Roof, Jews said one thing, thought another. The opening of the prayer, which is different from any prayer anybody in this room ever heard. No prayer begins Hanotein Shua Lamlachim, and the reason it does is because they knew their book of Psalms. And the next line was Pitseini Vahatsileini Miyad Bnei Nechar Asher Piem Diber Shav Yeminam Yemin Shaka. Rescue me, save me from these foreign governments who speak falsely, and so on. Doesn't mean everyone who makes that prayer makes the connection to Psalm 144, but nevertheless, very often I think that relationship was in people's minds. Nevertheless, the manifest, I'm not talking about the latent or secret language of the prayer, the manifest language of the prayer really bespeaks an obsequious, that's the right word, relationship that developed between the Jewish minority and the ruling authorities based on the assumption that kings and royal officials generally would protect the Jews against attacks of the rabble. Now, I don't have to tell you that assumption didn't always work. Think of Ferdinand and Isabella, and that was a great shock to Jews. More recently, Tsar Nicholas. I won't go into Hitler. But nevertheless, there was a certain political ideology that was quite rooted in the Jewish political psyche, and you can see it really in our prayer. That's the essence of traditional Jewish politics. So then, how come all those people said there is no Jewish politics? Why didn't they say we do have a politics? We support the party in power. We support leaders. And we're very conservative. Why not say that? The answer really lies in modernity. When Jews in Western and Central Europe, I'll get to America in a minute, won that magic word to Jewish historians, emancipation. And since emancipation was based in Europe on the rights of Jews as individuals, yes, think France, 1789, we must refuse everything to the Jews as a nation and accord everything to Jews as individuals. So the fear arose that group politics would endanger Jewish emancipation and threaten those precious rights that Jews had so recently won. And Jews were very nervous about this. Indeed, nobody was more nervous than the Jews in England. If you look at the minutes of the Sephardic synagogue known as Beavis Marks, because those were the streets where it was. If you look at the minutes of Beavis Marks, you find that they, as late as 1819, they leveled the dire threat of excommunication, chayrem, against anyone, any Jew, who took sides on a political question or even voted in an election. Thank God that chayrem was lifted. It expired at least. But how do you explain that? I mean, why shouldn't Jews vote? And they were deeply frightened about stirring up old anti-Semitic canards that Jews formed a state within a state, that Jews cared more about their fellow Jews than their country. That was the great fear. And so even when Jews decided that indeed it was their civic duty to vote, and Jews generally, and at least in America, vote at a higher rate, much higher than many other groups in some elections. I haven't seen this election, but some elections, 80% of the Jewish community votes. In America, you're lucky if you get 60%, which I don't think they reached in 2016. In any case, when Jews voted, they learned to piously insist that, God forbid, they never dreamed of voting on the basis of any interests that they shared with fellow Jews. They only voted as individuals seeking what is best for their country. So that's really the tradition. We might call it the tradition of anti-politics, and that tradition was the tradition that Jewish immigrants brought with them to the United States when they immigrated in the 19th century. Even though in America, unlike in Europe, Jews won their political rights along with everybody else following the revolution. At the federal level, there is no Jew bill. In fact, Jews go unmentioned in the Constitution, and that's a good thing because it meant Jews won their rights along with everybody else, not like in many other countries where they had to be special, even England, where there had to be special laws about it. And similarly, as I say, the U.S. Constitution never mentions Jews and thereby treats them as equals under the law. And even though George Washington, the first president, in his famous letter to the Jews of Newport, promised Jews that religious liberty was, quote, an inherent natural right. Inherent natural rights are inalienable. They cannot be taken away. Very different from the European sense that emancipation was a quid pro quo, meaning we'll give Jews this right, but they have to change. If they don't change, we take the right away. Those are not inalienable rights. Inalienable rights are rights that can't be taken away, no matter what. But despite all of those many things, and that is, I think, what makes America in some ways politically distinctive, Jewish immigrants tended to exercise what we would call an abundance of caution when it came to politics. And I think that they felt especially cautious in the middle of the 19th century when they observed how viciously the anti-immigrant Know-Nothing Party attacked Catholic in a political involvement. Know-Nothingism was a sense that we're going to deprive Catholics not only of the right to immigrate, but literally of the right to be involved in the political process. We're going to limit their immigration, their naturalization, their political rights. So as fellow immigrants, you can understand why they were so nervous. Fortunately, the politics of hatred have long since disappeared from the American scene, as recent events have demonstrated. But it's easy, I think, when one looks at the 19th century situation to understand why leading Jews prudently forswore political involvement and bound themselves to rather, we might say, straight-laced standards of group politics. And basically, they invoked what the historian Naomi Cohen, who lives right here, described as four commandments. I gave them to you here, that defined official, that's the key word, official standards of Jewish political behavior. And these commandments really were repeated into the 20th century. Number one, Jews may not band together in separate political clubs. Number two, rabbis or lay leaders have no right to advise the community on how to vote. Number three, Jewish agencies must not use their influence to promote Jewish aspirants to public office, to political office. And number four, Jews may not support a candidate just because he or she happens to be Jewish. So those were the official community standards. The point of my lectures and we see it today and over the next few weeks, is that if you look at what Jews actually did, rather than what they reflexively said, one discovers that these commandments, like certain other commandments enjoined upon Jews, even some inscribed on two tablets of stone, were actually observed largely in the breach. People mailed these commandments in public, but they did not observe them in private. And an early example of this, and I'm so glad to give it to you, because even though I did this big book on Lincoln and the Jews, this document that you have on the back page was not known to us. There are only two copies of the broadside in existence. One of them just very recently came into the possession of the Library Company of Philadelphia, and they kindly scanned it. You can find it on the web. So it's not in our book, but it's absolutely remarkable broadside going back to 1864. And as you can see, it is directed to our Jewish brethren by something called the Jewish Union Republican Association. You are holding in your hands what I believe to be certain, unless somebody here has something in their attic, in which case, please let me know. This is the earliest American Jewish political broadside in existence. And the truth is that much of the literature on Jews and American politics would have you believe that there couldn't be such a broadside, that it shouldn't exist. It doesn't exist, but here it is. Now, the president who was running for re-election in 1864, we're going to come back to this document. The president running for re-election in 1864 was, of course, Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln's life actually coincided with the emergence of Jews on the American scene. Lincoln was born in 1809. I doubt there were more than 3,000 Jews in the whole of the United States, most of them concentrated in a few East Coast cities, port cities, in 1809. Nobody much took notice of them. By the time Lincoln is assassinated in 1865, large-scale immigration, in this case from Central Europe, lands that would later be Germany and Poland, had brought the Jewish population of the United States up to more than 150,000. So in his lifetime, you move from 3,000 to 150,000. And that, of course, also explains why lots of people were nervous about immigration. Immigration, they said, was changing America, which indeed it was. Of course, the growth of Catholic immigration was even greater than the growth of Jewish immigration, Catholic having been greatly influenced by the Great Famine in Ireland. Now, what makes Lincoln unusual is that he actually had Jewish friends and acquaintances at quite an early age. They go back to when he's a lawyer in Illinois. One of them, a Jewish lawyer and politician from Quincy, Illinois, whom he knew for more than two decades, and who he once described as, quote, one of my most valued friends, was a man also named Abraham, but his last name was Jonas. Abraham Jonas. I don't know if there's anyone from Cincinnati. Here, the first Jewish long-term settler of Cincinnati was Joseph Jonas. Abraham Jonas is his brother. They happen to come from England, from a quite religious family. Abraham Jonas had a very deep understanding of American politics in his day, and he believed that Jews were no different from other groups in America, and that they did have political interests, and that politicians could appeal to those group interests. In other words, at least privately, he did not abide by these four commandments. Just like Catholics and Germans and Irish had interests, so too Jews. He argued thus that the new Republican Party, which is taking shape in the late 1850s, should appeal to political outsiders, and he actually writes a letter on that matter, and he lists the outsiders who can form part of this new Republican coalition: liberals, free-thinking Germans, anti-Catholic know-nothings, and most remarkably, he includes in his list Israelites. That was the politically correct term in those days for Jews. So he is already suggesting, the Republican Party from then until now has been trying to win Jewish votes, but he suggests that they go after a Jewish vote, which is astonishing. We know that Lincoln is influenced by this idea of a strategy, and certainly he reaches out, personally to individual Jews. He particularly liked rather liberal German Jews, like the courageous anti-slavery merchant Jonas Wollman. In Strife Torn, the books call it Bleeding because there was so much strife, in Bleeding Leavenworth, Kansas. Bleeding Kansas, some will have heard that term. You've also heard the name, if you're from New York, and I bet some of you are, you've heard the name Wollman, the Wollman Skating Rink in New York, named for those Wollmans. Of course, now the rink is also named for Donald Trump, who remodeled it. Can't escape, yeah. No question, liberals, free thinkers, and young Jews were attracted to Lincoln's message, and at least some of them, I don't know how many, but at least one who was smart enough to write a book, supported Lincoln for explicitly Jewish reasons. There is a young Southern-born Jewish attorney named, good German Jewish name, Abraham Dittenhofer. And he converted from slavery, which he supported in the South, to anti-slavery, which he came to support when he went to college and moved North, because he writes, he came to believe that the Israelite, whose ancestors were enslaved in Egypt, ought not to uphold slavery in free America and could not do so without bringing disgrace upon himself. And this idea must have been around in the middle of the 19th century, because the very famous pro-slavery, he actually was a slaveholder, pro-slavery Jewish senator from Louisiana, a man named Judah P. Benjamin, later would be hold several positions, including Secretary of State for the Confederacy. But Judah P. Benjamin was actually rebuked on the floor of the Senate by Senator Ben Wade of Ohio for being, I think it's a great line, he called him an Israelite with Egyptian principles. And I suspect that our friend Abraham Dittenhofer did not want to suffer that same embarrassing fate. Now, in 1860, it's pretty clear that the majority of Jews had not supported Abraham Lincoln, notwithstanding the book of Exodus. A considerable number of Jews in the middle of the 19th century, especially in New York, worked in the clothing trade. And if you worked in the clothing trade, your livelihood depended on Southern cotton. And the way it worked, I know it sounds nuts, but the Southern cotton went north, and then they produced clothes, which they sent back to clothe all sorts of people, but especially slaves in the South. The relationship with the South was very important to Jewish clothing merchants. And lots of Jews also had friends and even relatives in the South, more than some other groups. Many Jews had relatives on both sides. And in the Civil War, it's not our subject, but in the Civil War, you actually had not a few cases of Jews fighting against their family members on both sides of it, including, I mentioned Abraham Jonas. He had children who literally met in battle on both sides of that. In European Jewish history, that happens in World War I and makes a big issue. It's worth remembering that in the United States, that already happened in the Civil War. But in any case, before the Civil War, in November of 1860, one of the great elections in American history, lots of Jews voted for the Democrats, anticipating a trend that goes even into the 21st century of Jews voting Democratic even when the Electoral College moves Republican. But 4 years later, in 1864, when our broadside appeared, the political situation had actually changed very considerably. Of course, the Civil War was on. The Emancipation Proclamation had been issued, freeing the slaves. Abraham Lincoln was now running for re-election. For much of 1864, the war had not gone well for the Union, and Abraham Lincoln was running very scared. It seems exceedingly probable that this administration will not be reelected, he wrote in a very famous memorandum, and hoping to keep his job and be reelected, he made a special effort to reach out to Jews. Now, the person who was in charge, against all of the rules, official rules that we read, the person who was in charge of that special effort was a very interesting man named Issachar Zachary. I read a lot about Zachary, and it's all new in this book, but Zachary was something of a mystery man. He was once labeled, it's a great phrase, one of Abraham Lincoln's most enigmatic intimates. I'm not sure if I'd want to be an enigmatic intimate, but in any case, what is important is that he was a podiatrist. The 19th century term for podiatrist was chiropodist. I think in Hebrew they still say chiropod, yeah? And that from chiropodist. And, of course, Issachar Zachary was a Jew. Now, feet problems, you should know, were very, very common in the mid-19th century. I only learned this working on this book, that the idea of well-fitting shoes that are properly sized and different right and left, that's a very modern idea. So you can all try and experiment, put your left foot on your right, your left shoe on your right foot, your right foot on your left, your right shoe on your left foot, and you'll need a chiropodist too. Abraham Lincoln's feet, for disputed reasons, did he have a certain ailment, did he not? But Abraham Lincoln certainly had painful feet. And our friend Dr. Zachary, without question, was tremendously skillful at curing feet problems, and he acquired hundreds of testimonials from very famous people, North and South, Henry Clay, John Calhoun, many other people, to prove how good he was. And my co-author, the great collector Benjamin Chappelle, owns those testimonials. I think many of them are on display on his website. Because Lincoln had bad feet, just after the Civil War starts, Zachary is recommended to Abraham Lincoln. He meets with Lincoln at the White House, and you can tell that Dr. Zachary was a Jew. You'd think you'd be so honored to meet the president, you'd just say thank you. But Zachary asked him for a testimonial. It's such a marvelous document. I gave it to you in Lincoln's own hand. That is a copy of Lincoln's own hand. If it were Lincoln's own hand, it would be worth a lot more. But you have to read this with me because it's so remarkable what Lincoln writes. He writes, this is September the 20th, 1862. That's the very week, by the way, that Lincoln decides on emancipation and announces it to his cabinet. Of course, it won't happen until January the 1st. But he writes, Dr. Zachary has with great dexterity taken some troublesome corns from my toes. He is now healing me, and I believe with success, for what plain people call backache. We shall see how it will end. This is absolutely vintage Lincoln. I read hundreds of Lincoln letters, and it's perfect. It's brief. It's to the point. It associates the president with plain people. That was a very important part of Lincoln's persona. And it's honest, even honest to a fault. Meaning, Athena's brother and I write dozens and dozens of recommendations for graduate students. I assure you, I would never say, we shall see how he will end. I don't think he'd get a job. But Lincoln, Honest Abe, that's what he wrote. He just met the guy. He's not going to give him a vote of confidence until he's a little more sure. It's just a marvelous document, not much related to our subject, but remarkable in terms of Lincoln. Anyway, it must have ended well because Zachary then meets with Lincoln on multiple occasions, and Lincoln then sends Dr. Zachary, wasn't really a doctor, but he was known as Dr. Zachary. He sends Zachary to New Orleans to provide intelligence, meaning that he was a spy, and, quote, it's an amazing quote, as a means of access to his countrymen, who are quite numerous. Those countrymen are Jews. And repeatedly, Lincoln described Jews using the word countrymen. They didn't have a country, but it means he recognized Jews as a people. And one of the problems was, how do you refer to the Jewish people? The word ethnicity wasn't known. The word race will later be applied, but Lincoln wasn't going to use it. So he calls them their countrymen. Actually, Zachary does go down to New Orleans, where there were a great many Jews in high positions. And we know that he spent a great deal of time helping Jews who had run afoul of the authorities and really engaging in what we would call pidyon shvuyim, meaning freeing Jews who had been taken captive for smuggling or for related crimes. And I write quite a lot about that in the book. Partly out of gratitude, Zachary, in 1864, at Lincoln's request, led an effort to win Jewish voters to the Republican re-election effort. He visited key states, he knocked on doors, he secured favors for selected Jewish voters, and he exhorted the faithful to actually get out and vote at the polling places. That's how politics works. One of the candidates might have worked harder at old-fashioned politics this year. In any case, on October the 23rd, probably at Dr. Zachary's behest, Lincoln met with, quote, certain gentlemen of the Hebrew faith to discuss the Jewish vote. That is, as far as I know, the very first time that any president had ever formally discussed that subject in the executive mansion. Of course, that's a no-no according to our commandments, but sensible if you want to win an election. And rumors circulated in Washington that these gentlemen of the Hebrew faith had offered to deliver the New York Jewish vote to Lincoln in return for suitable contributions. Of course, that was immediately denied. Lincoln's assistant, John Hay, some of you will recognize that name. He later would be one of America's most important secretaries of state, but he was still very young then. Lincoln's secretary insisted no pledge of the Jewish vote was made by these gentlemen, and no inducements or promises were extended to them by the president. I don't know if that's right or wrong, but I did find an amazing private letter in the Lincoln papers from a very wealthy Jew named Samuel Lewis, advising Abraham Lincoln to send any Jewish committees that needed political funds straight to him. I will furnish them such amounts as we see can be used to advantage. Nothing shall be wanting on the part of your friends here toward carrying the Union, meaning the Republican, cause. Lewis had good reason to be very grateful for Abraham Lincoln. A relative of his had been picked up for smuggling, and Lincoln, with the help of Zachary and Lincoln, meaning Zachary went to Lincoln and Lincoln let him off. And Lewis was very grateful. I have no way of knowing, or at least no documents have surfaced which would reveal whether Lincoln took this Lewis up on his offer, whether any money changed hands. I'm sure Honest Abe wouldn't have done such a thing. But it's fascinating to see what we would consider old-fashioned politics. This at a time when all the books tell us that's not the way Jews responded to politics at all. And it seems to me that the Jewish Union Republican Association broadside that you have is really another part of what we might call an ethno-religious strategy. Do we have time to... Do we have time to read some of it now? Well, let's look at... So, what are you pointing at? And I guess where... Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I'll come to that. I'll come back to number six in a moment. There. But before we get to number six, let me summarize. I don't know if we want to read the whole thing, although it's a new document, and historians love reading new documents. But you'll see here that they say that this is a very unusual document. Very few members of our persuasion have hitherto been politically active. The signers are from New York, from Pennsylvania, from Indiana, and they're very proud of being immigrants. They call America their adopted country, meaning that they weren't born there. And I can identify many, not all, but many of these folks, and they are from originally Central Europe. And they call upon Jews to support Lincoln, the champion of freedom, the emancipator of the slave, the preserver of his country. And if you look here, you'll see, in violation of all the commandments of proper Jewish political behavior, they proclaim the votes of the immense number of Jewish citizens will go far to determine the re-election of Abraham Lincoln to the presidency. Now, in real life, there is no way that more than 50,000 Jewish votes existed in 1865. Remind you, women didn't vote in those benighted days, and there 150,000 Jews can't be more than about 50,000 who could vote. But, and we'll see this over and over, the power of the Jewish vote has been exaggerated for effect in American politics from Lincoln's day to our day. But at the same time, they are right. In a close election, every vote counts. Look at the recent election, and it wouldn't have taken many votes to shift it. So in that sense, every vote counts, but it is fascinating that they exaggerate. Now, I think we won't have time to read the whole document here. That's homework. But what's fascinating is that the document actually ignores the major reasons why we might have imagined Jews would have decided to vote for Lincoln. That's what's so puzzling here. It doesn't talk about the many Jews whom he had appointed to office. It doesn't talk about the fact that Lincoln played a vital and central role in opening up the military chaplaincy to Jews. The chaplaincy law said that it was only open to ministers of some Christian denomination, and when it was brought to Lincoln's attention, and he is centrally involved, and he figures out how to have it changed, which wasn't easy, they construe some Christian denomination to mean some religious denomination. And because, I'm sure half the senators didn't know what that meant, but it didn't matter. Because of that decision, we today have not only Jewish chaplains, but Muslim chaplains and Buddhist chaplains, even a Wiccan chaplain, all because They're soldiers. They need them at some religious denomination. And most amazing of all, this document makes no mention of Lincoln's countermanding of Ulysses S. Grant's infamous order, known as General Orders Number 11, expelling Jews as a class from his war zone. And when Lincoln heard about it, he instantly overturned it. I will say much more about that next week, so stay tuned. But the document, by its very existence, indicates that Jewish politics, as we would define the term, certainly had come into existence by 1864. I mean, this is the most blatant political document, and so on. Now, Meyer Isaacs, I mentioned his father in the beginning, I'll mention him now. He was the editor of the New York Jewish Messenger and secretary of an early national Jewish organization with the long name, the Board of Delegates of American Israelites. He was aghast at all of these discussions of Jewish politics and the Jewish vote. He wrote, "The Israelites are not as a body distinctively union," that was the term for Republican, "or democratic in their politics. The Jews as a body have no politics." And that indeed is what he said in public, reiterating all those standards that we read earlier. Privately, it's great to be able to read other people's mail. Privately, if you look up Isaac's letters to Abraham Lincoln, and you can do that now on the web, he acted somewhat differently. He wrote a confidential letter to Abraham Lincoln assuring him that many Jews, himself included, warmly supported the Republican Party. In other words, he and other Jewish leaders, what they really feared was public discussion of the Jewish vote, lest that foment what they would have called rishus. Rishus was what Jews of that time called anti-Semitism. The term anti-Semitism didn't exist, but rishus did exist. And so long as discussions were only conducted discreetly, behind closed doors, that didn't bother people like Isaacs at all. Now, who better to work behind the scenes than a spy? Issachar Zachary, our friend, the chiropodist and ex-spy, had plenty of experience, and in another private letter that he sent to Abraham Lincoln, and I gave you that as number 6, just 5 days before the election that year, like this year, the election was as late as it could be, November the 8th, he assured the president the Jewish vote would swing his way. And his prediction was somewhat better than some of the predictions we read this year. "As regards the Israelites, with but few exceptions, they will vote for you. I understand them well, taking the precaution to see that they do as they have promised. I have secured good and trustworthy men to attend on them on election day. My men have been all the week seeing that their masses are properly registered so that all will go right on the 8th. It's hard to know what exactly he did. You could read that quote more than one way. I mean, to register and organize and get people out to the vote is certainly the essence of American politics. To have people looking too closely, which certainly happened in the 19th century. That's why America developed later, after this period, the Australian ballot, as it was called, the secret ballot. In this period, it was less secret. Whether that's what was going on is hard to know. All I can say is that it did go right. I don't think the Jewish vote really made the difference in 1864. What really made the difference was a string of Union military victories on the battlefield, divisions within the Democratic Party, and a really wonderful Republican slogan, "Don't change horses in the middle of a stream." That slogan could also save your life someday. "Don't change horses in the middle of a stream," a great slogan. Lincoln won re-election by 400,000 votes, and actually the Electoral College was even stronger. He won all but three states. What is important for our purposes is that the Lincoln years saw growing engagement of Jews in politics and growing appreciation for the potential of the Jewish vote. Now, most Jews, don't get me wrong, most Jews were not banding together in Jewish political clubs. Most Jewish leaders at that time were not advising the community on how to vote. And the Board of Delegates was not using its influence to promote Jewish aspirants to public office. And certainly, Jews were not supporting candidates just because they were Jewish. Indeed, Jewish candidates in the 1860s were few and far between, most of them intermarried, and folks who didn't identify with the Jewish community much, like Benjamin. Nevertheless, politicians like Abraham Lincoln had begun to appreciate the political potential of Jews, and political parties, with the assistance of Jews, were just beginning to reach out and target Jewish voters. And Jews like Abraham Jonas and Issachar Zachary and Abraham Dittenhofer and members of the Jewish Union Republican Association had begun to actively participate in the political arena. And all of this set the stage for the explosive involvement of Jews in the 1868 presidential election, which is next week's subject. Thanks very much.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.